Tech Weekly is sponsored by crunch.co.uk, expert online accountants for freelancers, contractors, and small businesses.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's program, we're finding out the latest games news from the UK's largest gaming conference, Develop, held last week in Brighton. Our fearless games correspondent Keith Stewart has been speaking with David Braben, creator of the game Elite, about his new games for the Kinect, as well as how a Raspberry Pi could be the future of computer science. We're also picking apart the financial results from the major technology companies, looking at why BlackBerry makers RIM have cut 2,000 jobs, and we'll find out about the legal tangle that Sony is in after the massive PlayStation security breach earlier this year. Now that the legal bills are being added up, who pays the consumers whose services were hacked? In the studio are Charles Arthur and Jemima Kish. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Guten Tag.
Well, speaking about hacking, Charles, anything interesting happened this week?
LOLSEC tweeted my phone number, my mobile phone number.
That's not very nice, is it?
Not really. And clearly they didn't think it was very nice themselves because they then deleted it.
Well, pretty much straight away. I mean, I don't really understand why did, was it a sort of a mean thing for them to do? Or was it a kind of like, hi, we're 13 and we're just going to do something?
There was a bit of context here, wasn't there?
Was there? What was the context, Charles?
I was trying to have some sort of interaction, conversation with one of the Twitter accounts, possibly controlled by one of the people at the center of LOLSEC called Sabu. But I was unsure whether it was actually that person or whether it's simply that the accounts are shared. And, you know, I was basically fobbed off a lot. But, you know, the other people who at the time were around from LOLSEC, one of them then seemed to think it would be a laugh to grab my mobile number, which, you know, at the time was around, and stick it up on the LOLSEC feed and just say, hey, call this number. Which, you know, a number of people did. Not that many, actually.
How many followers do they have?
They have about 300,000 followers.
And how many people ended up sort of contacting you?
About less than 1 in 1,000. But the interesting thing equally is also that another member of LOLSEC, or possibly the same person who put it up in the first place, deleted it pretty fast. So clearly they thought, actually, that's not the right thing to be doing. And also, the other thing is that the Twitter accounts of almost all of those LOLSEC people who had been around, so there's one called LOLSPOON, which is thought to belong to Kayla, Topiary, which was the Atopiary account, they've all gone quiet. And it's rather noticeable how last week around on Tuesday, there was a 16-year-old Londoner was arrested and was released on bail on Friday afternoon. There's some suggestion that it was one of the members of LOLSEC, a person called T-Flow, or known as T-Flow. And the silence that's come out of all the LOLSEC people, apart from the Sabu account, which, as I say, you know, it's not certain. You can't be sure that the credentials, that the logins aren't actually just shared around. There's been what you'd almost call a deafening silence there.
Jemima, have you ever had anything like that happen to you?
No, I am pretty careful about the details. Actually, having said that, my mobile phone number is kind of out there, but...
Well, it will be if you use Facebook and have ever accessed it from your phone.
Yeah, but I don't know. Maybe I should be more bothered about that kind of
thing. What I would say is, actually, there's a lot of people out there who think they're anonymous, and I can tell you that you're nothing like as anonymous as you think. People who have been tweeting me saying, you know, haha, actually, I discovered for myself that given someone's Twitter trail, given a few things, I was able to, you know, as a hacker's call, you can dox people pretty fast. I did that to two people in the course of an hour each on their Twitter accounts. I had their mobile number, I had their home address, I had, where they went to school, where they went to university, how old they were, could get it all.
And it doesn't take too much digging.
Wow. The difference is that a lot of younger people who sort of align themselves with anonymous think that because they say we are anonymous, that this confers anonymity. Fact is, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't, does it? Well, join us for the next 30 minutes of news and analysis on Tech Weekly from The Guardian. The Canadian smartphone maker RIM, best known for the BlackBerry, has announced that it's to cut 2,000 jobs, 10% of its global workforce. The company is struggling to maintain profitability in the face of increasing competition from Apple's iPhone and smartphones using Google's Android operating system. The company is also shaking up its second-level management with the departure of its chief operating officer, Don Morrison, who went on medical leave in June. His job is going to be split into two roles. RIM's shares have fallen by 45% since the start of June 2010 as delays with new products and the disappointing launch of the Playbook tablet, along with falling selling prices, have pointed to concerns about its longer-term future. Criticism has focused on the arrangement that sees Mike Lazaridis and Jim Balsillie share both the chief executive and the chairman's roles. Charles, why has this happened? How, I mean, what... can we see this from their financial results? Is this a long-term solution, or has Don Morrison, the outgoing CEO, become a sacrificial lamb?
Chief operating officer, Don Morrison.
CEO, yeah,
so he's sort of, you know, chief CEO is the sort of the day-to-day nuts and bolts stuff. Well, he went on medical leave in June. The suggestion is that this is partly because they're just not growing as fast as they were. And they're taking stock and looking around and saying, well, we've got a lot more people than actually we need. They made the acquisition of a company called QNX in 2010, which brought on a couple of hundred people. Now, they're getting rid of a lot more than that. Their problems really are that they are starting to look as though they've got just too many people. Prices of what they're selling are falling. Although they increased their profits in the quarter that they announced to the end of May, they're not growing as fast as the rest of the market, and they need to do something that's going to, you know, spice it up and keep the profits going.
Is the problem that they're on a burning platform like Nokia was?
Well, I sort of put it as a sort of a smoldering platform. Yeah, the problem is for RIM is that at the moment they're on the BlackBerry 6 operating system. They said they're going to have a whole lot new smartphones which are going to be on the BlackBerry 7 platform, but then next year they're going to shift over to QNX, which is what is used in the Playbook. So they're sort of trying to not just change horses in midstream, but they're trying to sort of vault horses. It's like they're sort of doing a hurdling race on horses in midstream.
Jemima?
Their tactic a few years back was that they try and open out their handsets to the consumer market, and they've arguably done a reasonably good job of that. It seems to be BlackBerry Messenger that the kids love. But also Apple and Android phones are starting to take a bigger chunk of the enterprise market as well. So that's arguably no longer enough of a strategy to keep their stake in the overall market.
So are the youth not using BlackBerries anymore?
Or no, they are, but I think any benefit of that is being kind of undermined by losing that chunk of the enterprise market. And they viciously contended some stats that Comscore released a few days ago about market share, which put RIM at 24.7% of the smartphone market, Android at 38.1% and iPhone at 26.6%. Comscore said that these are people's primary devices, and then RIM came out with a huge reel of statistics, like we're the number one sales of smartphones in the UK and Saudi Arabia and the Netherlands, according to GfK, and said that actually, as a secondary handset, a lot of people have a BlackBerry. So, but, you know, looking at those market share figures on the surface of it, it does not look good.
The thing for RIM is that they are about 50-50 between the enterprise and consumers, whereas the smartphone market generally breaks down about 70% consumers, 30% enterprise. So RIM is not sort of balanced in where the market is, which is why its smartphone sales grew by about 18% in the quarter to the end of May, whereas the smartphone market as a whole is growing at about 50%. So they're growing smaller than the market.
A lot of this has to do, I think, with focusing on a particular platform, doesn't it? And you mentioned that they're trying to vault over horses. They're trying to do all kinds of things with operating systems, Playbook, etc. I mean, the Playbook itself disappointed. Should they be focusing, in order to sort of reestablish themselves, should they be focusing their energies on software, on hardware, on the operating system?
Well, they're an integrated company. They do the software and they do the hardware. So Mike Lazaridis is the sort of the power there. Jim Balsillie is reckoned to be more the person who's the sort of the getting things done sort of guy. Their problem is that they need to really have something that's a breakthrough. And in this, they're competing against Apple, who are really, really good at the design, at the making things work, at the really enjoying. And they're competing against Android, which is just, we'll really just innovate. It's, you know, we'll make it sort of better as fast as we can. And they just stumble over themselves, pushing out new versions of operating systems that are a bit better, a bit better, a bit better.
What about the iPhone 5 and the Samsung Galaxy?
Well, you don't have to wait for an iPhone 5. I mean, just look at an iPhone 4 or an iPhone 3GS. The thing that holds back BlackBerrys from a user point of view is that... they have a small screen and they have a mechanical keyboard. And when you look at apps, which are really the really compelling thing about smartphones now, they're at a massive disadvantage in their design because they have less screen space in which to provide these apps. I've tried and tried again to explore the BlackBerry App Store and to try and get into them, and it's just, there's no comparison with a really good Android phone or the Samsung Galaxy S. It's a lovely phone, and the iPhone, from a consumer point of view, there's no comparison, and I just don't see, without a really radical redesign of software and hardware, how they can compete.
It really all goes back to January 2007, when Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone, and part of the demonstration, part of the presentation he gave, he showed a whole lot of the existing smartphones that are out there, and they are all upper half screen, lower half mechanical keyboard, and he just said, you know, look at all these. How do you change the layout of these phones to change how your apps are? When you have a different app, you need a different layout for the keyboard. How can you do that? Have you got a fixed keyboard? And that was the thinking behind the iPhone, the Touch iPhone, and that's still the weakness that the RIM has.
Who are these two people who are coming into the new?
They're being promoted up into the COO job, and one's on the sort of the sales side and one's on the product side. But it's still just being promoted from within RIM. I don't think we've heard the last of the management tensions inside RIM, because there's a lot of sweeping difficulties under the carpet in terms of how the company is functioning. And I think that there's going to be more tensions which will come out through this year.
Well, we've heard about the fallout from the disappointing RIM results, and over the last few weeks, the other major technology company, from Apple to Nokia to Microsoft, have released their financial results. Charles, you are the numbers guy. What's the overall trend?
The overall trend is, well, it's sort of mixed. Apple had profits up 124%. Its revenues for the quarter were $28.57 billion, up 90% year on year.
Holy guacamole. And
profits of $7.31 billion. That's 20.34 iPhones sold. So clearly it didn't need to have an iPhone every summer.
That was way above the estimates as well, because the analysts were saying 15... If they get 17, that'll be a bonus, and they sold more than 20 million. So they are rocketing.
I mean, well, what can we expect? Just focusing on this particular result, what can we expect? Because they're gonna have saturated the market by this time.
The expectation, rumors I'm hearing are that there may be more than one iPhone coming out in September, and
that's been around for a while. Though, is this the kind of nano iPhone nano idea, the kind of cheap end of the market?
The iPhone slightly cheaper. To get the prepaid market.
It makes sense.
Because the prepaid market is far bigger than the contract market generally.
But they've always wanted to go for high end of the market until now, haven't they? It makes sense in some ways, and then other ways it's sort of counter to the premium product.
Yeah, but they go, when they're ready to go for market share, then they go for market share. Mm. You know, Steve Jobs was very critical when he was not at Apple about the fact that the management at Apple, when he was away, just went for profit and didn't go for market share. And you saw with the iPod that when they could extend from the original iPod outwards and downwards, they went with the iPhone, the iPod mini. Mm. And that was a huge, that's really what drove their success there. And then they just segmented the market, just chopped it up into pieces and
so
just owned it all.
So what they're now going to be doing in terms of diversifying is going for the prepaid market. They're going to try and convert BlackBerry.
Yeah. Exactly. They're going to try to get anyone they can, really. You know, contract buyer, that's great. Prepaid market, that's great as well. You know, there's an enormous market out in Asia which wants to get iPhones. There's huge potential there.
So what about Nokia, the other...
Nokia, who used to be the kings of the mobile world. The Finnish phone makers who used to be paper mill. They used to provide one-third of the UK's toilet paper back in, I think, the 80s, and got into mobile phones when they were still young. They've had a really bad quarter. They lost a total of €368 million, and that's despite Apple having given them a one-off payment of $430 million. If you look at the numbers, that means that they actually lost a total of 798 million euros. Jeez. On revenues of 9.3 billion, which means that roughly for every £9 they got in, they let 10 go out the door.
That's basically what I do.
I was thinking, God, that's a lot of extra shopping. Why did Apple give them this cash?
That was the result of a long-running dispute between the two companies about patents. And Apple made a settlement out of court in which they gave them a one-off payment. It related to patents to do with mobile technologies. And there's a sort of cross-licensing, except Nokia doesn't get some of the key iPhone patents.
They also, this year, they tried to curb this tide, this flow of money, by reducing their numbers. There was, you know,
not very successfully.
Yeah, no, they're sort of trying
to reduce the number of people
So employee numbers.
Yeah,
I have those stats right here. Let's compare Apple, Nokia, Google, and Microsoft. So Google has 26,000. Apple has 49,000. Microsoft has 89,000. Nokia has 138,000 employees.
I don't know,
maybe they're still making toilet paper. I don't know what they're doing.
They're the ones who are taking the extra tenner. They're taking the extra pound and sticking
it in
their
pocket.
Exactly.
Wow.
Something like that.
So why? So what is going on? Nokia, we've seen this. We've looked in our pretty opaque crystal ball and we've seen this pretty clearly, what's been happening. So what's happening with Nokia and how can they turn this tide?
Well, they can't really turn it because their problem is people are not buying Symbian smartphones now. The number of smartphones that they sold fell dramatically to 16.7 million. They used to sell more than 20 million every quarter. It was just regular. So the number of smartphones has fallen to levels last seen in 2006. Their mobile revenues overall have fallen to levels last seen in 2005. They are in a bad place. They're not going to have a Windows phone device until October or so. And the carriers feel that they've tried doing the price thing, but actually they get undercut by Android, and people think the Android experience is slightly better. So Nokia's going to have a really tough rest of this year.
Back to making toilet paper. What about Microsoft?
Microsoft had a very good fourth quarter. It beat the analyst expectations. Revenues of $17.4 billion, profits of $6.2 billion, which makes it the second quarter in a row since 1991 that Apple has done it better on revenues and profits. The numbers were really good in the office segment because it's been selling all those installed PCs, new copies of Microsoft Office. However, the Windows and Windows Live division, which is basically licensing of PC sales, it increased, but it didn't do too well. In fact, the revenues dropped by 1% year on year. PC sales are slowing. They're sort of peaking, really. They're really not growing, especially in the West. They're not growing. Might be growing in the East, but there's so much piracy out there that Microsoft doesn't get the benefit.
Just briefly, as a sidestep, what areas of tech are performing well and which are performing badly? So we've spoken about mobile phone technologies. Is it software? Is it hardware? Is it PCs? Is it mobiles? Is it games? What's still doing well in this quarter?
Smartphones are doing well. Apple had a really good quarter with tablets. We don't get any visibility on Android tablets, though the suggestion is those aren't exactly flying off the shelves. Software in the form of Microsoft Office is doing well. Services is doing well because IBM had a good quarter. PCs, not so great. Google had a great quarter. But Microsoft had a really dire quarter in the online services division. Revenues of $662 million, which is down in terms of revenues compared to last year. And the loss is $728, which means that for every $10 they get in, they're giving out about $25.
Jemima.
I've got some more stats here on the annual returns for these four companies. Nokia, again, not doing so well, down 42% annually. Microsoft up 10% a year. Google up 26%. Apple up 53% return in a year. I'm not a betting lady, but if I was, I'd probably be doing the stock market.
And you'd be doing very, very well. Briefly, Arm, the British company Arm. What's happened with them?
Arm, which is the UK company that basically provides the architecture, which is then actually built by other companies for smartphone chips and a lot of car chips, digital TV set chips. They've had a good quarter. They've had higher revenues than ever before. Profits are up, revenues are up. They are really sailing along, actually.
Go UK. Great. Well, back in April, 77 million accounts on the Sony PlayStation Network were compromised. At the time, Sony said that anyone who had incurred any losses would be compensated, which, you know, that's pretty impressive. The massive data breach is expected to cost them £109 million without compensation to users. So Sony has turned to its insurance company to help pay the costs. 3 months later, 55 gamers are taking legal action. And as the company prepares for the courtroom, it's come to light that Zurich American, one of Sony's insurers, are seeking confirmation that they should not be liable for current or future losses that were incurred because of the hack attack. Zurich contend that they do not cover the type of crime that was committed, and nor did Sony cover the loophole in its network that was responsible for the data breach. Oops. State and federal regulators are also investigating, and that could also end up before the courts. So, Charles, is this typical that insurance companies don't cover computer hacking like most insurers don't cover acts of God?
I think that it's really hard to get insurance against computer hacking because it's such an unknown. Insurers like to cover against what they can know and measure.
I've been looking into this a bit, and it's now a $2 billion annual industry, the global premium volume, and most of that comes from the US. But two big hacking stories of the last few years were Heartland and TJX, which are card payment processing firms. Those kind of privacy risk insurance cases are up like 100 to 150% every year. And those two cases paid out about 100 million. So this is a massively growing area of the insurance industry. But going back to Sony, Zurich is, and this is obviously lost in legal wrangles now as well, but they are basically going to argue that they provided Sony with general liability insurance and it was never intended to cover Sony for digital attacks, and certainly not if Sony is found to have been quite lax in its security. I wouldn't want to speculate on that, but if you look at the costs, it's not surprising that Sony is going down this legal route because it cost them about 178 million. PSN, which is like Sony's version of the iTunes store, basically was down for 2 months. So as well as the liability of exposing people's credit card details, they have had to rebuild the PlayStation network and they've lost revenues. It was the second largest breach in US history. They think they now have 90% of the users back, but they will be looking at all sorts of options for recouping that money. There's even been speculation they might release PlayStation 4 a bit sooner to try and boost their revenues, but it's looking pretty grim for them.
Well, read up on all these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. Last week, the global games industry had its annual Knees Up in Brighton at the Develop Conference, and we promised you some treats from the Brighton seafront. No, there is no Brighton Rock, sorry to disappoint, but Keith Stewart, our games correspondent, did catch up with veteran games designer David Braben, who's the founder of Frontier Developments, also the creator of Game Elite, and creator of gesture-controlled game Kinectimals. Whew, that's a hard word to say. David has another game on the way for Kinect Disneyland Adventures, the first open-world Disneyland game, where the whole 86 glorious acres of Disneyland from Frontierland to Tomorrow's World are roamable by pointing in the direction where you want to go. GTA Disney, anyone? Keith started by asking David what it's been like developing for Kinect so far.
What we're doing is we're building, I think with all Kinect games, we're still learning how best to do it. And so we're taking another step. If you like, this is one of the first of the sort of second generation Kinect games. And by that I mean where the developers have already done one Kinect game, we're now doing our second. So we've learnt an awful lot from that process.
What do you think is the the most valuable lesson, is it? Because you did a speech yesterday, and it was at the conference, and it was I think it was about learning a new vocabulary of making games, and this is something that Microsoft have said as well, because it's a new way of thinking about control, isn't it? Because it's totally physical. There's nothing in your hands, and there is no grammar for that in games, is there?
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, when we first got Kinect, right in the early days before we did the Kinect Models game, we didn't even know how you would pause the game, select a menu. So, you know, we've built an awful lot of steps on that. And it echoes to me quite a long time ago when we first got controllers that people were resistant. I mean, a lot of gamers are quite conservative. You know, oh, it's new, therefore it's bad. And the keyboard and mouse crowd said, oh no, these controllers, they'll never catch on, they're not precise enough, and all this sort of thing. But what actually we're doing with controllers, it took about 3 years before there was an accepted sort of language, for want of a better term, or vocabulary of what each button does. With Kinect, we're moving along that path. But Kinect is very, very interesting because the controller is really off-putting to a lot of people. Just the sheer number of buttons on virtually every surface. You give a family member, a parent, for example, who's not really familiar with games, a first-person shooter when we're sort of playing as a family, and they'll end up looking at their feet within about 10 seconds. You know, it's just not that natural. So that's one of the things that, you know, we're going through a learning process with Kinect, but actually it's much quicker. If you look at someone who's not familiar with it, you know, a few minutes later they're playing and they're fine and they're delighted.
So with Disneyland Adventures, how did that come about? Did Disney approach you? Did they approach Microsoft? And what were they looking for out of the game?
Microsoft approached us because we'd already been working with them, and I think we have a very good relationship with them. They already had a relationship with Disney at that point, so I mean, really honoured that they did come to us. But it's great, and it's a fantastic opportunity. I've always really loved the various Disney characters, and it's the first time we've worked with them, so it's very exciting. I mean, one of the things that we wanted the experience of visiting Disneyland, which meant we have to have the whole game open from the start. But we have lots of quests, lots of adventures you can do. I mean, if you think of those who know games, think of the structure of GTA, but think of a sort of non-violent GTA, if you like, where you can go up to different characters. These are the iconic Disney characters like Mickey Mouse. And he will ask you to do things. He, for example, is standing as mayor, just to give an idea what these stories are. And he needs but Donald Duck standing against him. So he needs more votes. He needs you to get pictures of him to help promote. But also, we do have the attractions. Now, what's interesting, the Imagineers in real-life Disneyland, for example, think of the Peter Pan ride. They try to give you the experience of flying. Now, we've talked to them about it. We actually want to give them you the... actually make you so you can fly. So it's sort of one step beyond.
And you said you've worked with the Disney Imagineers, who are the people that essentially come up with the rides and other attractions at Disney. Did you find a lot of common ground with them? Because obviously you're both dealing in the world of interactive entertainment. Is there common ground, or are there lots of very big differences between the way you both approach entertainment?
Oh, I think there is. I mean, it's quite interesting. I think that Disneyland is a really good level design from a game point of view. You know, they've thought carefully about the things that that we think about, you know, things like sight lines and how you design a game so that you can see where the next bit is, you know. And so, although actually there is a slight frustration in that they don't have any rendering limitations. So, you know, we've had to come up with some quite innovative solutions to how we render something that's so big.
Yeah, but they do kind of have a version of lag, big queues, I guess.
Well,
and you're also here with something else that you've created, the Raspberry computer, which is a fascinating story and kind of came out of the blue earlier this year, something that probably a lot of us game journalists wasn't expecting to happen. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Raspberry Pi is a charity that a group of like-minded individuals, including myself, based in Cambridge, formed because we've seen that all of us had a fantastic opportunity when we were kids and young teenagers to learn how to program computers. There were wonderful computers like BBC Micro, Acorn Atom, Sinclair Spectrum. I mean, each person has a different personal experience of whichever one they had, but each one allowed you to type in listings and things like that, which may sound very dull these days, but you got a feel for how the machine worked. And also you could mess around with it, you could do stuff with it, and just press a button, it would reset, you wouldn't mess it up. But there isn't the equivalent these days. These days, the tools, there are a lot of things that are quite simple. Wonderful things like Kodu, actually learning within games. If you look at Halo Forge, Little Big Planet, Roller Coaster Tycoon, Spore, they're all very creative. But then there's a big gap. Beyond that, you can't go beyond that. And then there are great tools, things like Microsoft XNA, once you actually are pretty familiar with the programming process. It's the gap that's the problem, which something like the BBC Micro filled in my day. Nowadays, I don't think it would be cool, so we're trying to come up with a computer. This computer, we believe we can make for less than £15. And the idea is to give them away to children so that they have access to things. It doesn't include a screen, it doesn't include a keyboard, and it would be the perfect machine for schools. Anyway, that's the plan, and it's very exciting.
Have you had interest from charities and from schools?
It's astonishing and really heartening, the number of people who have offered to help. That includes charities, distributors, all the people who can, you know, people who can provide components. And so, you know, I think that's a really, really big positive. We're just doing another round of prototypes now, and the intention, we've had a lot of interest from the third world as well, which we didn't quite expect to the degree. So it can support output to something called HDMI, which is for modern flat screen TVs, but also we're adding in composite video, which supports older TVs.
And what about the OS? Does it run Linux, or have you got a new OS that you've developed?
Right, it's running Linux. It's running a version called Ubuntu. But what we plan to do is put a layer of software on top of it so it's friendly for children and quite robust. In terms of how we want to release it, we're looking at releasing a developer version this year, which won't be the kid version. We want to try and build up a decent software base before we go for... And we may even sell that machine at a profit in order to fund the later machine.
Okay. In terms of saving, I presume, because I've seen it's very small, isn't it? Does it have a hard drive on it? Are you saving to the cloud? Will people be able to use cloud?
Right. It has network on it, and it also supports SD cards, so micro SD. So it's micro SDHC. So it goes up to 32 gigabytes. Although I think we probably only supply 1 or 2 gigabytes with it, which compared to the sort of things people are producing will be quite big. So in terms of how that works, yes, you save locally to SD, but it's like a hard disk. It's like, you know, saving on a lot of modern laptops don't have hard disks these days.
So what do you hope to see from it? Let's say in a year's time when you're prototyping it at the moment, when you have hundreds of thousands of them possibly. What are your hopes for it?
I would like to see something that makes kids really engage with the wonder of creating things using technology. One of the problems at the moment, we're great consumers of technology, and there are problems in schools, subjects. ICT is a real problem because it's really teaching office skills. It's not teaching the wonder of computer science, actually. You know, simulating things in a very, very simplistic way that I know and have seen children engage with very, very quickly. And it's that sort of sense of wonder and sense of exploration that I think this could bring back.
Maybe could you put maybe a Linux version of Elite on there as a sample, because that's, if there's anything that's going to inspire children and remind them of the brilliance and beauty of the 8-bit days, it will be that.
Who knows? I think, to be honest, firstly, the code is pretty intractable. And secondly, these days, a game that's that hard, if you imagine docking for those who remember it, they might not want it.
David Braben from Frontier Developments with games correspondent Keith Stewart. We'll have more from Develop over the coming weeks, but you can keep up all week on more games news at guardian.co.uk/games. That is all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Jemima Kish, Charles Arthur and Keith Stewart. We are doing some research on our program to see how we can make it better. And we asked last week if you wanted to get involved, so please do. If you want to take part, we will only ask you a few questions. Email techweekly@guardian.co.uk. Also, email that address if you want to sponsor the podcast. That's techweekly@guardian.co.uk. See all the links from this program and the email addresses to get involved for research or sponsorship at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky, and no, I'm not going to bend to consumer pressure. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Tech Weekly is sponsored by crunch.co.uk. Stuck in the accountancy stone age? Crunch's cloud software and team of accredited accountants will take care of all your paperwork, expenses, tax liabilities, and more for a flat monthly fee of £59.50 plus VAT. Visit crunch.co.uk for a free trial.